Humans and animals have cohabited on the planet for hundreds of thousands of years. But in recent times, that relationship has become a bit strained. As human populations expand into what was once the territory of wild animals alone, we have drastically altered their natural environment and living conditions. And the dilemma of how we should consider and treat wild animals has never been more difficult than it is right now. Emma Maris is an environmental journalist. She spent a lot of time thinking about these issues. Her latest book is called Wild Souls, Freedom and Flourishing in the Non-Human World. Emma, welcome to Life Matters.
Thank you. I'm so excited to be here.
We're happy to have you. Now, when you were growing up, you spent quite a bit of time at the Seattle Zoo in Washington. How did those experiences shape your thinking about wild animals?
One thing that I think a lot of zoos do is project an image of being conservation organizations that help wild animals as well as take care of the animals that they have in the zoo. And so it sort of trained me to think about wild animals mostly as instances of their species, sort of here's one polar bear that stands for the whole species, rather than worrying about that particular polar bear's happiness.
So you don't buy the argument that going to a zoo and seeing these animals can spark a kind of wider interest in nature generally?
Well, I did for many years. I took my own kids to the zoo. But when I came to write this book about how we should interact with wild animals, I decided to dig into this sort of claim that zoos are a very strong conservation force. And the more I looked, the more I found that there was not that much going on in zoos to justify these animals being stuck there. And I also found a lot of research suggesting that many of them are really very unhappy in captivity. So I began to change my mind about how zoos are currently run. I think they do need to change quite a bit.
That was a really interesting thing for me to learn, that there's a lot of culling of excess animals in zoos, and that animals develop tics that some scientists say are evidence that they're not happy. Can you tell us a bit more about that?
Yeah, so in a lot of the larger mammals, and these are, you know, often the animals that people are most excited about seeing, things like elephants, bears, or tigers, being in captivity will see them develop these repetitive behaviors like swaying or pacing or sometimes flicking their tongues. And these are generally seen in the field as signs that they're not mentally well, that they're unhappy.
And Emma, you came up with this interesting idea for how zoos should change. It sounds a bit like they're kind of, that they would grandfather losing animals over time. Explain to us how that might work.
Well, so zoos do have conservation breeding programs where they're breeding animals that they hope to put back out into the wild someday. But these are actually very much the minority of the animals that you see at the zoo. So what I think they should do is sort of transition over time towards mostly doing that kind of conservation breeding, that the goal is to get the animals back out. And that means stopping breeding animals like elephants or tigers where it doesn't really work to put them back out into the wild, where they don't, that kind of reintroduction doesn't really work. So take care of the animals that you've got, you know, lavish them with love and care, but don't breed more if you know that they'll spend their whole lives in captivity at the zoo.
It really, your book really made me question the way we think about wild animals, because they do have a particular status in our thinking, don't they, as compared to pets or livestock or random city birds and mammals?
Yes, I mean, I was always brought up to sort of say, let nature take its course. And the sort of first rule of dealing with wild animals was don't mess with them and don't influence them and don't get in their business. But the question that my book asks is that still a good enough rule when we've changed the whole earth? And so we've changed their lives, even if they're far away from our cities.
So are you saying there are no wild animals, truly wild animals left anymore?
Depends on how you define wild. If you define wild as completely uninfluenced by humanity, then yeah, I don't think there are any wild animals left. But I kind of go in the book to redefine and rethink about wildness as having more to do with the freedom of individual animals to sort of do what they want to do all day.
Well, and that's really interesting, isn't it? Because I think when a lot of us think of wild animals, they do have a special place in our hearts. We have this romantic idea that they are free. You know, they might be free to be eaten by a larger animal or to savage some smaller animal, but it's a particular uncontrolled space in our imaginations as well as in the world. Are you saying that that's not true for wild animals anymore?
Yeah, and actually, you know, I came to Australia twice to do the reporting for this book because it's especially true in Australia because of the kind of intensive management that's required to protect some of your most special native animals there. So there's just a ton of fence building and, you know, killing of cats and foxes and hands-on management. And then, of course, on layered on top of all of that, there's agricultural management. There's also climate change. So yeah, all of the animals that we think of as wild back of beyond, they're living in lives that are shaped by human action.
That was a really interesting point where you visit this conservation reserve in South Australia, and there's that tension between killing the introduced animals to preserve the native animals. What are some ways that humans can navigate that?
This turns out to be, I think, one of the most difficult ethical conundrums that I talk about in the book, because we all want to save endangered species from extinction. But in places like Australia, that often means killing a lot of individual other animals. And we got to remember that these cats and foxes and rats and mice, you know, they don't know they're the bad guys. They don't know they're in the wrong place. That's where they were born. So it is ethically tricky to balance our sort of duties to be kind to individual animals with what we think of as our duties to stop things from going extinct. It's a really tricky one.
And it's also about the delicate ecosystems, isn't it? A lot of times in Australia, you know, the hooves of the introduced animals mash up these delicate balances of different organisms. And I know that you've written about that in a previous book too, that you say that our responsibility is to not stop all change, but to preserve the ability of ecosystems to adapt to change. Isn't it the same for the animals? We need to make sure that native animals in places like Australia can continue their species, even if that comes at the expense of some of the introduced species?
Yeah, so I profile two different kind of schools of thought in the book. One, which is that we can mostly do good by trying to remove introduced species like cats and foxes, and that this is just how we're going to have to do it. And then another school of thought, which is that actually cats and foxes might be able to coexist with some of these animals in the future, especially if we stop killing dingoes so that the dingoes can then control the cats and foxes. And so you get into this idea of a future food web, which is quite a bit different than the past food web, but that might be able, theoretically anyway, to perpetuate all the species. And there's so much research that still needs to be done on these questions, but I think it's very interesting that people are asking them.
It was interesting too, the South Australian Conservation Reserve trying to teach a few successive generations of native species how to be scared of predators. Were they successful?
Yeah, this is such a fascinating project at Arid Recovery, which is a really great reserve. They're trying to see if they can not just teach individual, you know, bilbies and bettongs to learn how to be wary around cats, but actually to sort of breed a lineage of these animals that can coexist with cats by letting them be exposed to low numbers of cats. So they're actually kind of trying to fast forward evolution here. It's really interesting.
Is it working?
Yeah, well, preliminary, it's very early days, right? You know, they have to wait for these things to breed and reproduce, and luckily some of them are pretty quick. But I was there and I was able going into the two different enclosures, one where they had been working on this and one where there were no cats and hadn't been cats for gazillions of generations of these animals. And you could see the difference in their behavior. We almost ran over the animals that were not used to cats because they were so chill and unwary and they were not nervous at all. Whereas the bilbies and bettongs in the other enclosure were much more likely to scamper out of the way, because they had to live with a small number of cats. So you could, even though, you know, that's not an official data collection, but their papers also suggest that they are seeing some effect.
I found it fascinating too, Emma Maris, how you talk about this idea of flourishing, that we want to make sure that animals can experience flourishing in their world. How can we tell? Like, how can we see into an animal's mind and work out how it's feeling about its life?
Yeah, we can't, which is what makes it so difficult, you know, and we can't just sit down, you know, a bilby or a bat or something and say, well, what really makes you happy? What counts as a good life for you? So we have to sort of infer it from what we see, how we see their behavior. So going back to the zoos, you know, if we see a tiger pacing back and forth, back and forth, back and forth, that's a way that the tiger can tell us that it's not flourishing. In the book, I argue that for a lot of animals, if we give them more space and more opportunities to make their own choices, they're more likely to flourish in their own ways. We don't have to know exactly what makes them happy and provide it for them like they're our pets. But if we give them lots of space and kind of the resources that they need, they can choose their own flourishing.
We have to know a bit about them, though, don't we, to work out what kind of choices they might make, what kind of resources they might need to make those choices.
Yes, that's true. And sometimes we don't know. I mean, there's fun stories about animals that were very endangered coming back, and then suddenly you see them behaving in ways that people didn't expect because we just didn't know enough about their behavior. I think that there will always be a gap there between what we want, you know, this sort of perfect happiness we would like to see for every animal, and the fact that ecosystems are made up of food webs, which means that in order for the predator to be happy, there might be suffering for the prey. And that's the kind of tension that I end up with at the very end of the book, which is that nature itself is not set up to make everybody happy all the time.
Well, and the other thing too is that you note that we're quite vested in the idea that some animals don't feel pain or don't feel much pain or don't mind if we fish them out of the water or things like that. And you discover that fish actually make plans and are curious. And I had to blow some of my ideas out of the water there. That sounds
me too. That was a tough one for me because before I read that research material, I ate a lot of fish.
Yeah.
And now, you know, I think that we get brought up with this idea that fish are just different somehow and they don't feel pain and they're not like other animals. But they are. They're just underwater. It's really mind-blowing.
And it makes it, as you said, it's quite an ethical minefield. Do you have some rules for us, Emma Maris, that we can use to make these decisions about how we interact with wild animals and non-wild animals?
Yeah, I mean, you know, when I started the project, I knew that the rule of just let nature take its course was no longer good enough because humans have sort of become nature in so many places. And I was hoping I'd find a really short, pithy answer just about that same length to guide us now. But unfortunately, it's just not that simple. There's going to be so many case-by-case decisions. So in the last chapter of the book, I do offer a kind of like a framework for working through your own sense of values, what's important to you and what you value, and then applying that to some of these conundrums. But it's never going to be quite as simple as just hands off.
Well, yes, and one of the options is choose the least morally wrong option, and another one is if necessary, grieve. Is there going to be a certain amount of grieving when it comes to humans making decisions for and about animals?
Yes, definitely. I mean, we've made, you know, as a species, we've made some bad decisions in the past that have locked us into some bad scenarios now. And the introduced predators problem is a prime example. I mean, I think that in some cases, we may well choose that we need to continue to kill some of these introduced animals to save native species. But that's a painful decision. It's not something we should take lightly. And it may be that instead of inuring ourselves emotionally or demonizing the animals as if they're somehow bad guys, that we should allow ourselves to grieve a little bit if that's what we feel like we have to do.
Well, and when it comes to pithy aphorisms, you did include a very lovely pithy quote in the start of your book from a book called Braiding Sweetgrass on Flourishing. Could you share that with us?
Well, I'll have to just go to the bookshelf and pull it up here. Luckily, I've been using copies of my own book to hold up my computer for Zoom calls. So here it is. All flourishing, she says, is mutual.
That is a lovely way to end this. If we can keep that in the front of our minds when we're making our difficult choices, that may help. Emma Maris, thank you so much for joining us on Life Matters today.
It was a pleasure.
Emma's the author of Wild Souls, Freedom and Flourishing in the Non-Human World, as well as other books and opinion pieces. Very interesting reading if you look up her writing online.
It's easier than ever to hear your favourite local and national ABC radio stations, live and on demand on the ABC Listen app.